This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences, and the humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Ramat, we critically unpack theories, frameworks, and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope will shed light on the world around you. Today, Fuad can't be here, but I'm joined by Meredith Wise. Meredith is an associate professor of political science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs at the State University of New York at Albany. You know, we're actually at this point in time watching the run-up to the American presidential elections, and it's just at that phase where the parties have to decide who's going to be their nominee. So in this kind of American political discourse, not just what they're talking about, but how they're talking about it, that's interesting. And for a show like ours, it's to ask how scholars view this phenomenon, how they're framing it, and are they, in fact, the best people to understand what's going on and what's going to happen in the future? Are political scientists going to be able to predict, for instance, you know, the results or at least some of the key dynamics in the American political game? What do American political scientists do? Do they do it about places like America? What are they saying, and what have they been saying?
Well, American political scientists are fairly divided in terms of what they focus on. So we have a school of people, a large number, who focus on American politics. And in many ways, that's taken as the baseline for the discipline of political science in the U.S. There is still a sense that politics in the U.S. and Western Europe our base understanding of what politics should look like or how we should understand institutions, how we should understand political dynamics, that, of course, is really fundamentally wrong in the sense that we have a full variety of different political cultures, political systems, political arrangements, and political dynamics if we look globally. So for me, for instance, I focus in comparative politics, which is a subdiscipline which looks at the domestic politics of different states. International relations, for instance, in the U.S. context, not the British framework, focuses on the relations between states. So from my perspective, the U.S. is a comparative case like any other. So the reading I'll give you of American politics should be seen in that light. I'm always thinking of it as compared.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because the things like the Journal of Democracy, which I think largely subscribed to by political scientists, right? But I can't remember actually seeing an article about America. It's often about non-American societies in the process of democratizing.
That encapsulates much of the norm, I think, and the specifically normative sense within so much of American political science. And I won't even attempt to defend that because I don't find it particularly defensible, partly because I am a comparativist and can see this is somewhat problematic. But so states like the U.S. are taken uncritically in many cases, or at least critically, but still not with quite the same lens as democracies, despite the fact that we know that if we look only at expansion of suffrage, for instance, it's only with the expansion of suffrage to non-whites, to women, to others in the early part of the 20th century that we could even begin to call the United States a democracy in that very minimalist sense. But in all sorts of other ways as well, we know that U.S. democracy is fundamentally flawed. Levels of participation, levels of political discourse can reach really low depths. So many don't vote. In a presidential election year, we hope that a majority will vote. In an off year, that's rarely the case. We vote at all levels. So in all sorts of ways, U.S. democracy is flawed. But you're right. These journals of democracy, for instance, whether JOD itself or others of its ilk, tend to consider the U.S. as a liberal democracy and therefore beyond the ambit of a journal of that sort. At the same time, I don't want to give the impression that there are no critical works on U.S. democracy. And an election like this one really helps to bring forth some of those analyses, some of the predictive capacities of the discipline, however limited those are, and so forth. So there are plenty of people who do critique U.S. democracy, but it tends to be in a different forum from the critiques of or analyses of regimes elsewhere.
You know, I do understand that some departments of political science were or still are called departments of government. So what is it that distinguishes a department of government from a department of political science?
In practice, nothing at all except the name on the wall. However, the choice of what to call the department, in some cases at least, is a purposeful one. In others, it's simply a legacy of what it was called in, you know, whatever year the university was established. There's a debate within the discipline That's a long-standing one. It dates at least back to the behavioralists of the 1950s, who started to use more statistical methods, more quantitative approaches, to try to find a more rigorous way to study human behavior in politics. And that debate relates to whether or not political science is, simply put, a science. Do we have general laws, governing laws, as the hard sciences do? Is there an equivalent to gravity in the study of politics? And the debate rages on. So an ambition within the discipline of political science is for theoretically relevant, theory-building work. The question, though, is at what level we pitch that theory. Do we have anything that could be a general law, a theory that applies to all society? Or are we looking for what we term middle-range theory, theories that would describe or apply to or explain something about a bounded set of cases? So the developing world, or liberal democracies, or advanced industrial societies. Or do we look simply for what we would call deviant cases or confirming cases that will help to bolster the theories that we have? The closest thing we have to a general theory in political science, and it's a hotly debated one, is the idea of a rational actor. It's what we call public choice or rational choice. And that is to say that humans have preferences, know their preferences, rank those preferences, and pursue the maximization of their interests as they've identified and ranked them. How we define those interests, though, varies. So we start with a fairly economistic understanding, which sees our interests as fundamentally material. Rational choice theorists within political science, though, have expanded upon that to what we term a thick rationality, to say that actually our interests may be comprised of a range of different subsets, some of which are material, some might be more social or emotional. We might seek reputational benefits, for instance, as opposed to material benefits, as an explanation for altruism or for engagement in different forms of activism. But in truth, the limits to that sort of general law are quite stark. And so because of that, there's a real question as to how scientific we can be in the sense that we understand it. The other divide there, although it does not map neatly onto the departments that are called government versus politics versus political science, is how quantitative or experimental or formal, in the sense of using econometric models, our approaches are.
Meredith, what's your personal training? I mean, your own personal trajectory. Is it knee-deep in this kind of positivist approach to understanding politics?
It's hopping as fast as I can out of the positivist approach. In fact, I'm trained much more as an area specialist as well as a political scientist. So one thing I should just mention, in case it's not familiar, is that in the U.S., when one does doctorate in political science, the first 2 to 3, and now increasingly sometimes even 4 years, are spent in coursework. So learning the canon, learning the literature, learning methods, increasingly rigorous training in both quantitative and qualitative, and often also interpretive and experimental or formal methods. Formal, again, are the econometric models. My training is a mixture of quantitative and qualitative. I picked up more interpretive methods along the way. I really have nothing to do with formal models as much as possible. I can read basic ones, but I don't use them in my own work. But my own research has been overwhelmingly, probably 98% qualitative. So I tend to use the same sorts of methods that, for instance, an anthropologist might use in the sense of field research and interviews, observation studies, as well as recourse to things like archives and documentary analysis and so forth.
So are you in the minority here because of this kind of approach? Would you say that it's become increasingly interdisciplinary, a mix of methodologies that have in fact come to define the discipline today?
If you listen to the paranoid discourse, you would think I was in some really soon-to-expire minority, but I don't find that to be the case, in fact. So on the one hand, there is an increasing emphasis on what's being termed multi-method research. Ever since something of a revolt within the political science discipline in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was called the Perestroika movement in political science, because we're really creative in coming up with new terms. And that was a move for methodological diversity, to move away from what was seen as a growing hegemony of quantitative methods within political science and of a very positivist framework. The idea that to use a positivist framework rather than a more interpretivist or a normative framework requires that we assume that there are things that can be essentially counted, that there are facts on the ground and we need to accumulate them and therefore come up with our correct judgment.
Qualitative or quantitative, interpretive or, you know, statistical, isn't the proof of the pudding really not just in explain what just happened, but in some sense, to understand what's going to happen in the near future?
That is the holy grail of political science, this idea that we can predict. In fact, as many have pointed out, helpfully, political scientists have not been very good at predicting things like the fall of the Soviet Union.
What about anticipating? Maybe anticipating would be a better word than predicting.
To a large extent, that's how I see the sort of middle-range theoretical work that I tend to do, which is to say that we identify patterns, we identify trends, we look at processes that seem to follow in sequence, and therefore I can't tell you. For instance, however many journalists may ask, will Najib fall? Will Malaysian politics change radically? And on what day? I have no clue. But I can look at trends, compare Malaysia with other places with a similar system of governance, a similar economic level, a similar social structure, whatever else, and try to identify patterns from what I know about how regimes function, how institutions function, how individual agency is modulated by institutional frameworks, and so forth. And then I can come up with a nice, safe semi-prediction that's really much more of identification of a pattern that may or may not play out at any given moment, but is likely to play out over time.
Okay, so maybe political scientists set themselves up for a fall when they use science as a mantle. That seems to be the point at which they're going to trip up. But in terms of real understanding of even what happened in the past, there's a kind of adequacy in the interpretive framework. Has there been a sense that there's something wrong about the traditional view of understanding politics?
There is a sense that there's been something wrong at the same time that there's a sense that there may not be a better way to do it. And so, for instance, that's the real benefit of, again, what's been called multi-method research. So what I mean by that is, for instance, one might start with a survey of data cross-nationally. You pick all the countries in the world, you identify the phenomenon you're interested in studying, you find statistical indicators that might measure what it is that you're looking at, you look for broad patterns through a basic regression analysis or whatever tool you want to use. And from that, you then might, for instance, say, well, there are these outliers that are really interesting. Let me look more closely at those. And it's the outliers that are often most useful to look at. Or you might just look at a random selection of cases to try to see what exactly is happening. Quantitative methods can give us the magnitude of a causal effect. They can tell us how much X is correlated with Y, but it can't tell us how or why. That's where we really need a more qualitative approach to investigate what are the mechanisms behind this. So, for instance, one of the, for a long time, dominant very few dominant theories that was seen as a general theory in political science and the social sciences broadly was what's termed modernization theory, associated with people like Seymour Martin Lipset in the 1950s and 60s. That says that if we look at advanced industrial states, we find that most or all of them are democracies. There seems to be, if we align up all the countries of the world on a graph, a correlation between economic development and what was termed political development, which is democratization. And therefore, the theorists concluded it must be that economic development causes democratization. When we start looking at the outliers, places like Singapore, for instance, we say, well, actually, no, that doesn't actually seem to hold, that there may be an overall correlation, but that mechanism that Lipset identifies is really something about the middle class. But if the middle class develops with a different relationship to the state than was the case in Western Europe, for instance, in a framework of GLCs, of state-led development, of the developmental states of East and Southeast Asia, we don't see the same pattern. And so that's where we really need that combination of methods to give us some ideas of what might be patterns, but then to investigate what's the mechanism behind.
Okay, I think we've laid the base and framework for talking more deeply about America. And we're going to start the next part of this show with an article from The Atlantic titled Admitted Political Scientist, Politics is Really More Broken Than Ever. But we'll be back for that. You've been listening to Meredith Wise. She's an associate professor of political science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs at the State University of New York at Albany. I'm Sharad Kutin. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. Welcome back to Night School. I have as my guest Meredith Wise, associate professor of political science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs at the State University of New York at Albany. Now, we're going to start with an article from The Atlantic. It's titled, Admit It, Political Scientists, Politics is Really More Broken Than Ever. It comes with a subheading, Scholars Restrain Themselves Out of Fear of Being Seen as Partisan, but What's Happening Now is Different, and False Equivalence is No Virtue. Now, that's quite a complicated notion. So what's going on here, Meredith? What is it that the author of this essay, Thomas E. Mann, what is he trying to say or suggest?
There are a couple different things. Number one, he starts off and throughout the piece runs a simple basic analysis of the current U.S. presidential primary debacle, and specifically the Republican side, this clown car of candidates, each seemingly worse than the next, and the most popular of them having no chance at all of being elected and being really fairly egregious representatives of the party. Trump, Carson, a couple of others. So not to let my own, you know, partisan sympathies fly, but at the same time, this is not a good batch of Republican candidates. So Mann is, on the one hand, trying to explain why it is that this batch of candidates, of those with very limited experience, very limited knowledge of foreign policy, extreme right-wing views within the U.S. context, which has in part an economic left-right continuum, but really much more a fairly religious and social issue-oriented continuum of what we consider to be on the right and on the left. So it's rather different from the European context in a classical sense. But at any rate, he's asking, you know, why do we see these candidates? How do we analyze this? And one of the benefits of political science, of the social sciences broadly, is that we can get perspective. Instead of just looking at this current presidential cycle and saying, oh, this is crazy, we can look over time and see what's behind this. Number one, is this really unusual? And he argues it is. And number two, is it just something about the Republicans? Is it the full country? Are we really just falling into a heap? What's going on? And he says that actually, and Pew studies and others have been showing this for the last several years, we have currently the most polarized society and specifically Congress that we've ever had. So there's increasingly little middle ground in a two-party system. Actually, in any place that has a first-past-the-post, a majoritarian voting system, whether it be the U.S., whether it be Malaysia, whether it be any other, we tend to find that parties move toward the center. They all want to capture this fictional median voter who Downs wrote about as being kind of the center of the heap. We assume that there's a normal distribution of voters, a bell curve. And that therefore, if it's a winner-take-all system, if you have one seat and the candidates contest for that one seat and you need a plurality of the vote, everyone's going to move toward the center. And so we've always assumed that U.S. society is largely a normal distribution. Most voters are somewhere near the middle. If we have a bimodal distribution, two peaks, a strong left and a strong right, the two parties may differentiate themselves and hope that those voters are geographically situated such that you have red states and blue states. And the Reds will be run by the Republicans in the U.S., the Blues by the Democrats. And indeed, U.S. society seems to be increasingly bimodal in its distribution, and some of that is geographically aligned. So the first-past-the-post single-member districts can indeed be pursued by parties farther on the left or farther on the right, respectively. And he argues that this is happening. But he also suggests that political scientists, as a group, have been somewhat loath to argue that the Republican Party has moved to a far-right position. The Democrats, in fact, have not moved so far as Republicans, although it's worth noting, and he does not, that Bernie Sanders is about as far left a major party serious contender I can think of that we've had in a while. He's an avowed socialist. We haven't had that in the U.S. for quite some time now. So there is a drift leftward amongst the Democrats as well, but it's definitely more extreme among the right that's been pulled. The Republicans have been pulled by this Tea Party wing over the last really decade at this point. And so he asks why political scientists don't call that out as what it is. And he says that if they're seen as saying, ah, it's all the Republicans' fault, they've moved to the right, that's pulled our politics into a morass, now we have this gaggle of candidates that no one can take seriously, the U.S. reputation slips every time Trump opens in his mouth, what should we do? That if political scientists articulate this, that will seem partisan because they'll be seen to be attacking the Republicans rather than actually identifying an observable, documentable trend within the Republican Party, which is that on issue positions, they have moved farther right than the Democrats have moved left.
Is that a problem necessarily? I mean, clearly in a democracy, you have your whole spectrum of political views. If the Republicans, you know, if Donald Trump, as a real estate tycoon, decides that this is his politics and he's anti-immigration or if he's anti-Islam or whatever, if he can get the votes, he can get the votes.
He can't get the votes. But that aside.
So the problem is, for political scientists, is the job them to pass judgment on candidates or is it simply to describe what's going on?
There are two things at issue here. One is the majority, estimates tend to say somewhere around 90% of political scientists in the U.S. are left-leaning. And there is often from critics of political science or critics of those who use federal funds to study things they don't want studied, a critique that, we're all going to indoctrinate our students and try to turn them into little, you know, bleeding heart liberals. That's actually not the case. Most or all of us can very readily separate our teaching from our own political proclivities. The fact that you have partisan leanings doesn't mean that you can't be fairly objective and analytical, both in teaching and in conducting research. But there is that assumption, and we see that articulated in sometimes really vitriolic debates over federal funding for the National Science Foundation, which funds political science research, among other areas, and so forth. And so there's that piece of it. The other piece of it is simply this question of whether we are casting judgment on candidates in a partisan way or whether we are evaluating politics. In point of fact, those can't be separated. And that's part of what Mann is arguing, that it's not partisan. It's not trying to sink the Republicans. If one points out quite verifiably that indeed there's been a shift within the party. And yet there still is this sense that we need to appear impartial, even if that then by definition limits what we can actually study.
One of the things I noticed in the article that I was really taken by was a reference to Austin Rani. Now, he wrote in the 50s about the two-party system. What's interesting is how you think America's political system is structured in such a way that if the political parties become less big tent parties, they become more ideologically coherent, it actually has a debilitating effect on the system because the system kind of assumes certain political party structures. And so the shift is really problematic. And what the article does is it says that, you know, his views were prophetic and a dissenting view of American politics at that time. Can you explain that? Why was he prophetic and dissenting? So what was the mainstream thinking when they saw the very same phenomena so differently?
Really, ever since Downs wrote his Economic Theory of Voting in the 1950s, I can't remember the precise year, the conventional wisdom has been that in a two-party system where you have first-past-the-post voting, winner-take-all system, parties will move toward the center. Most people are somewhere in the center. And that means that, yes, the party on the right will have its tail to the right. The party on the left will have its tail in terms of distribution of voters and issues to the left. But there'll be a fair amount of overlap such that even in a presidential system where we have division of power, policymaking can still happen. So the fundamental difference between a parliamentary and a presidential system, the reason this matters and can be debilitating in a presidential system, whereas it functions really differently in a parliamentary one, is the division of powers. In a presidential system, the president and vice president are elected separately from the legislature. And so if we have the president from one party and the legislature coming from another party, or in the U.S. system, a bicameral system, Congress may itself be divided between two parties. Policy gridlock may happen. The benefit of a parliamentary system, which can also be a cost, is that you have a fusion of the legislature and the executive. The executive emerges from the legislature and is accountable to the legislature. You can have a vote of no confidence. In a presidential system, it's only the people who essentially can change a president. In extreme cases, yes, you can have a president impeached, but that's an extreme circumstance. In general, the executive in a presidential system is accountable to the voters, not to the Congress. The benefit of this system is that you tend to have greater policy stability in presidential systems. A change of party for the president or for Congress may not be across the entire system. And so you tend not to have radical swings in policy. It's too hard to get those things across. In a parliamentary system, it's actually easier to accommodate ideologically cohesive and polarized parties. You may have, in a parliamentary system, more radical swings between policies. Because if a new government with a capital G comes into power, they control both the legislature and the executive. In a parliamentary system, because of that, there's greater party loyalty. And so a new party can sweep away legislation from the preceding party and really change things. So you can have more decisive policy action, which is good and bad. So you may also have more erratic policies over time. Presidential systems are seen to be stable, and many, like Kwan Linz, have argued that these are preferable in many ways because of that stability, but then also problematic because of the possibility of gridlock. And so if we have ideologically coherent and polarized parties in the U.S., we risk getting nothing done. And that's been part of the problem now. So, for instance, the U.S. does need gun control legislation, whatever the NRA says, National Rifle Association, we need it. It's probably not going to happen because of the ways in which the parties are aligned, the electoral imperatives guiding the different parties, and the fact that there's a difference of opinion. So we can have executive action. We can have these presidential executive orders that will say, okay, I am hereby making a change on immigration. But that's seen as less legitimate and is definitely less binding in the long term than for Congress to pass legislation on X. But if you have real division between the parties on things like immigration or gun rights or reproductive rights or whatever the other flashpoints are, let alone economic policy, you're less likely to be able to push things through. There's no coherent agenda, and that is problematic.
Okay, we come back to that part of the phrase and the standfast, the false equivalence issue. Correct me if I'm wrong. So the Democratic Party remains a big tent party. It has a whole range, or rather a wider range, a wider spectrum within it. The Republicans, and this is where the false equivalence applies, the Republicans have not. They've become ideologically more narrow. And so, you know, in some sense, it does mean Obama's kind of strategy of always reaching out to a kind of bipartisan Congress to try to think nationally in terms of the public good was mistaken. Was it in some sense his own failure to recognize that the ground had shifted from under him, that American politics had changed significantly? The hostility towards him was not just because he was African-American or biracial, whatever it is. It really is that there was something that had changed at the very heart of American politics.
I think that's a good analysis of especially the first part of his presidency when he had Congress in his party. And we should have seen, by all measures, a stronger legislative agenda actually passed because he could do it. In other words, he could articulate a policy in line with his party, and then his party, which controlled Congress, could do this. But at that point, and many wrote it off as political naivete or misreading the ground, he instead, and Congress instead, reached for bipartisan agreement, for a compromise, and so forth, which may be great in the abstract, but was not achievable in the days of the early Tea Party when the rift in the Republican Party was becoming more clear. So on the one hand, we can argue that the Democrats have remained a big tent party and the Republicans have not. In fact, the Republicans still are a big tent party, but there's a real division. So the right wing of the Republican Party, which is not a big tent wing, it's really on the far right of U.S. political spectrums. That wing is dictating much of the decision-making, it seems, in terms of choice of candidates, in terms of policy preferences and so forth among Republicans. And there is a more centrist Republican establishment, but they seem not to be really so much in control. The Democrats, one may say, just simply lack a clear ideological position right now. That's debatable. I think there is one, but it is still more accommodating. The Democrats have also shifted left of center, but not, as Mann describes and maps on a chart, not to the extent that the Republicans as a whole have shifted to the right of center. And part of it is that tailing margin is now far more substantial. It's more of a blob than a sort of normal distribution with a tailing residual.
Now, okay, so we come back to the question of Donald Trump. I think it's interesting because there was this joke, a joke going around that he was a plant by the Democratic Party. The Democrats had sponsored Donald Trump to somehow discombobulate the Republican Party because he's such a polarizing figure. less so in American society, but certainly in the Republican Party. If all the other candidates are having to deal with Donald Trump all the time because of his outrageous statements, I mean, what does it do to the party? Now, it's not just him making these outrageous statements, really that it's resonating with some part of the ground, a significant part of the ground. So what's going on with Donald Trump and what is he an expression of?
So in some ways, there's actually less space in policy positions between Trump and some of the other Republican contenders than tends to be seen. It's just he being Donald Trump is larger than life, is used to commanding attention, used to having his name in bright lights on his buildings and so forth. So he can command the media spotlight in a way that Ben Carson, who is just as far right, or even Carly Farina from HP, who's also quite dogmatic and on the far right, in a way that they don't. So he just is more of a media personality in some ways, I think. And some of the things he says are indeed deeply polarizing, and for those of us more on the left, are fairly horrific to hear. So we see a shift across so many places, including Malaysia, toward a greater xenophobic rhetoric, a greater nationalistic rhetoric. And Trump is probably right now the leading candidate for articulating that strand in political thought within the U.S. He, in some ways, is a less serious contender than, for instance, Le Pen and the National Front in France, or Pauline Hanson, and you know, others of that ilk. So that would be Australia, but we've seen this in so many other countries, and it rises and falls. So at the moment, he's the one articulating this because he gets so much media attention, because we blow up all of his statements into far more valid critiques of American society than they really merit. That, I do think, has a certain validating effect for those who share his positions. That doesn't mean that these are dominant in American society or that he has a chance of winning, but we do see them magnified at a time of a lot of xenophobia, insecurity, and just uncertainty about the political climate, the social climate, and what's going on in the U.S. and globally. So there's that effect. And I think part of the issue really on the Republican Party side, and I don't think Mann in his piece would disagree with this, is that the fragmentation within the Republican Party, the fact that we do talk about maybe there'll be a split, maybe there'll be a third party emerging from the Republicans, is that there isn't kind of a force that's able to pull the candidates toward the middle. Part of that is just an artifact of the primary system. And it's something that is not unique to the U.S., but different there. And that is to say that the voters choose who the party's candidates are. And so in the primary system, during that part of the electoral cycle, the candidates are working against candidates from within their own party instead of across parties. And so we tend to see more of a racing to the margins. You don't have that same pull to the center. You're looking at the median voter in your party rather than median voter overall. And so we tend to see a more left-wing and right-wing discourse among the Democrats and Republicans respectively during the primary election period. And at this point, the Republican Party, as I said, it's not so much the usual kind of centrist bulge and then a tailing margin, but a much larger margin. And so we see a greater number of candidates, including Trump, looking to seize part of that farther right constituency than we can find on the Democratic side.
Can the Republican Party refuse Trump as a candidate?
I'm not actually sure. So there's been a petition circulating by Democrats, which seems odd, asking the Republican parties to deny him. I don't know if this has happened, but so if he were to win the primary, and it varies by state who can vote in the primary elections. In some states, only voters registered with that party can vote in the primary. In others, any voters can. So then if it's a state in which any voter can, yeah, Democrats could rush to the poll and elect Trump, the Republican candidate. I don't think he's a Democratic plant, but at the same time, it would be very good for the Democratic Party if he were the Republican nominee.
I would love to see the history where parties open themselves up to non-party members and make decisions like who's on the list and who's the candidate.
You know, a lot of it really just relates to the party structure. Again, we don't have the same level of party discipline in the U.S. that we have in parliamentary systems. There's no need for it. It just has to do with the history of the parties in their state-level branches over time. But if we're assuming states in which only registered voters from that party elect the nominee, right? I'm simply not sure if the Republican Party establishment could say, yeah, the voters have chosen and we really don't like this guy. I think there would probably be more backroom pressure somehow to make him withdraw, or really marshaling the resources of the party behind a more acceptable candidate, acceptable to the mainstream Republican community. This usually happens naturally. He ran last time as well. He also flamed out majestically at that point. And if we think of the Sarah Palin phenomenon, though, we do have candidates of the far right who have made it pretty far and who have not really done the party any favors. So there are always going to be some who will vote for the one that they find pretty or they think will be, the classic line is, a good person to have a beer with or whatever else, rather than the one with foreign policy experience. That was, as a political scientist, one of the depressing things about following, you know, the discussions of, you know, Kerry, McCain, all these other, Bush, all these other candidates, was John Kerry, as a Democratic candidate, yeah, he seemed to have good policy positions, foreign policy experience, seemed smart, but stiff. Bush, you'd have a beer with him. And so people voted for Bush. I was like, you're not going to have a beer with the president. The president's going to be making policy. You should vote for the policymaker. And so some of that is just surveys don't necessarily capture the underlying dynamics so well all the time. But at the same time, there is that level of decision making is not always based on the qualities that are specifically relevant to that office.
All this is fascinating. I think it's really going to be an interesting year in the run-up to the presidential elections, both the primaries and the elections itself. And Meredith, if you can recommend somebody to read on American politics or follow as a publicly engaged academic, who would you suggest?
There's a kind of geeky web journal out there called Jacobin, which has had a lot of really interesting pieces with a lot of political scientists contributing, so I might recommend that. Jacobin, yeah. There is also a blog called Crooked Timber, which is a political science-y wonky blog, which has a lot of good information. Mother Jones I find to be the best magazine in the U.S. for investigative journalism. Much of it on the left, but they do have really good analyses of things like campaign finance, of different political issues and so forth. So I would, rather than necessarily just saying go to read the work of one political scientist, I'd recommend those sorts of sources. And apart from that, it's just the specifics of who's writing on what tend to vary a lot. But if you look in those sorts of places, you can find people cited whose work then it's easy to follow up on.
Okay, so that's a recommendation. I remember Mother Jones famously for that Mitt Romney video where he, as presidential candidate, was speaking to the less than 1%. That was then, wasn't it?
Yep.
So Mother Jones, Crooked Timber, and Jacobin. Thank you so much, Meredith. Meredith Wise, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs at the State University of New York at Albany. Always a pleasure to have you here, Meredith. We're going to probably patch in closer to the presidential elections, getting your views. We're not a current affairs program, but it's really fascinating to have a sense of how scholars devoted to examining some phenomena could have such different views of it and, you know, have serious blind spots and in some instances, of course, epiphanies or real insights. So I look forward to more insights on the American spectacle, which is, of course, the presidential elections coming up at the end of 2016.
November, yeah. Although the primary season starts earlier and earlier each time. So I think the first ones are late January now.
Oh, by the way, Meredith, are you on Twitter? No? Okay. You can get in touch with Meredith if you write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or interact with us on our Facebook page, which is BFM Night School. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Sharad Kutin, and you've been listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.